You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It's no exaggeration to call Adam Hochschild one of America's best narrative historians. In his new book, To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918, Adam examines World War I, one of the greatest and most puzzling examples of civilized evils in history, and the now obscure civilians and soldiers who waged a bitter, often heroic struggle against it. I absolutely could not put this book down. If you associate the word history with the word dry, just forget it, because this is a book that will just keep you on the edge of your chair. My own galley is crisscrossed with exclamation points and notes, and I knew that John Wiener was reading Adam's book, so I often began my morning by emailing him, you know, with my blood pressure boiling, about British commanders I thought should have been tried as war criminals and not as heroes. General Sir Douglas Haig actually complained when British casualties were too low and exulted when they moved into the tens of thousands. These are just some of the amazing facts that Adam has culled from diaries and letters and all kinds of sources into an incredibly compelling narrative. As Christopher Hitchens pointed out in his front page review of Adam Hochschild's book, World War I almost sent civilization into total eclipse, and the conflict itself did not really terminate, he said, until the democratic reunification of Germany after November 1989. What kind of courage did it take to be a dissenter against this juggernaut of patriotic insanity? Who were these citizens who risked imprisonment, hard labor from their government, ridicule and ostracism from their families? Hochschild, focusing mainly on Britain and the Western Front, brings these figures to life. Adam Hochschild has won a reputation as a master of suspense and vivid character portrayal with his books King Leopold's Ghost, Bury the Chains, and others. His skill at evoking individual struggles for justice amid the sweep of historic events has made him a finalist for the National Book Award and won him a host of other prizes, and we are so honored to have him here tonight. We are also very honored to have John Wiener, who is a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine, where he specializes in recent American history. His books include Historians in Trouble, Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower, Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI File, Professors, Politics, and Pop, and Come Together, John Lennon and His Time. And for those of you who are not familiar with John's afternoon drive time radio program on KPFK, which features interviews on politics and cultures, it's one of the great treasures of Los Angeles. So apparently there are those who agree. Please welcome Adam Hochschild and John Wiener. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, and thanks to everybody for coming. This, for me, this really is the book of the year. I share Louise's excitement about it, and she's absolutely telling the truth about those early morning emails that we would exchange. Just want to sketch out, first of all, a lot of people know a lot about World War I, but just remind us of some of the basics. We know a lot of people got killed in World War I. How many?
Well, more than 9 million soldiers and an estimated 12 to 13 million civilians. We'll never know that number with any precision. And I think to measure the impact of it, you have to remember that Western Europe had never experienced anything like this before. This was more than six times the number of deaths in the largest previous war, the Napoleonic Wars, which stretched over a period of 15 years. And then to have more than six times that many deaths all concentrated in a 4.5-year period, it was overwhelming and had many, many other consequences as well.
And I hadn't realized the extent to which this wasn't just a matter of the working classes of Europe killing each other.
No, this was one thing that particularly fascinated me about this war, and I think has fascinated many other people who've written about it, which is this. Normally, the elites of any country, the people who decide on when we go to war, are very good at getting other people to do their dying for them. You look at the Americans who've been killed in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, very, very, very few children of CEOs, senators, governors, anything like that. But in the First World War, it was the other way around. The young men from the upper classes died proportionately in greater numbers than people from the rest of society, because it was the traditional thing in all the warring countries for young men of good birth, as they said in those days, to become army officers. And it was those young captains and lieutenants who led their men out of the trenches and into a hail of enemy machine gun fire, conveniently for the sake of enemy sharpshooters, distinguishing themselves by wearing distinct officers' uniforms. And they got killed in enormous numbers. The men who graduated from Oxford in the year 1913, 31% were killed. Lord Salisbury, who was Prime Minister of England at the turn of the century and the patriarch of one of the country's great landed families, had 10 grandsons. 5 of them were killed in this war, and one of them is a character in this book. And that kind of statistic can just go on and on. The General Sir Herbert Lawrence, who was chief of staff of the British Army on the Western Front, lost 2 sons in the war. His counterpart in the French army lost 3 sons, and yet the war just went on and on and on.
So what makes your book different from other World War I books, as Louise suggested, is it's not really about the English fighting the Germans. It's about the battle among the English, between those who thought the war was necessary and a good thing, and those who thought it was a disaster. And the way you bring this story to life is through a few outstanding individuals. I want to talk about some of my favorites. You open with a chapter called Brother and Sister, which I found just stunning. Who were the brother and the sister?
Well, the sister, to begin with her, is a woman named Charlotte Despard, who was an ardent pacifist. During the First World War, she was one of the most outspoken opponents of Britain's participation in the war, traveled up and down England, speaking to anti-war meetings. Many of the gatherings she spoke to were broken up by, you know, people throwing rotten eggs and tomatoes, or shut down by the police. And before the war, she'd taken part in all the principal radical movements of the day, had been to jail 4 times in the battle for women's suffrage, strong backer of independence for India, every other radical cause you could imagine. And when I was first sort of learning something about her, I was reading a very boringly written scholarly article describing her life. And just one sentence in passing, the writer said, naturally, Mrs. Despard's activities were deeply upsetting to her brother. And it gave his name, Sir John French, which I immediately recognized as Commander-in-Chief on the Western Front. So I knew this was going to be an interesting relationship to explore. And indeed it was. And the remarkable thing was that this brother and sister had these diametrically opposed points of view on everything conceivable, but they were quite fond of each other, continued to see each other throughout the war, and finally stopped speaking only when in 1918 he became Viceroy of Ireland, when that job meant leading the charge against suppressing Irish nationalists who were agitating for independence. She went to Ireland to work for the IRA. And at that point, they ceased all communication. But that gave me the idea of structuring the book around divided families. So I went looking for other families that were divided by their feelings over whether or not this war was something that was worth fighting in, and I found several of them.
Before we get to the other ones,
yeah.
I want to stick with the brother here,
yeah.
Sir John French. This is one of the people Louise emailed me about more than once. What kind of war was Sir John French expecting to lead the British in fighting?
Well, you know, he was a rather likable fellow, and I think of all the people in this book, he might have been the most enjoyable person to spend an evening with. Very witty, knew large patches of Dickens' novels by heart and could recite them.
Always a great.
Great ladies' man. Women found him absolutely irresistible. But he, like many of the military men of this era, had grown up and made his career in the cavalry, which was the natural place to go in the late 19th century. You know, riding a horse was something very identified with the upper classes, with the aristocracy. The cavalry had been the crucial element in winning wars for a couple of thousand years. It was also the part of the army, in England particularly, and I think the same was true in other countries, that attracted the most aristocratic and the wealthiest officers, because you had all sorts of expenses as a cavalry officer that were beyond your salary. You had to belong to certain clubs, you had to maintain a couple of polo ponies, you had to have grooms to take care of your horses, and only people with independent incomes could afford that. And French, like many generals of this era, was convinced that it would be cavalry that would win the big war that was going to come, because it had always won wars up to that point in time.
For 2,000 years.
For 2,000 years. And nobody really thought about what it meant for the other side to have machine guns and barbed wire, because it was always the British or the French or the Germans who, in colonial wars in Africa, had been the ones who'd had machine guns and repeating rifles and so forth.
You had an astounding statistic about the German cavalry, how many mounted soldiers the Germans sent to the front in 1914.
40,000 in 1914. I mean, can you imagine it? You know, in an age when you know the other side has barbed wire, which renders a cavalry charge absolutely impossible, how can, you know, a man with wire cutters and a couple of hours to spend work his way through a 50-yard field all covered with barbed wire, much less, you know, 5,000 horses in a charge, and into the face of machine gun fires.
I think you said this was the largest mounted force ever to appear in Europe, the history of Europe.
That's right.
August 1914. So that's the kind of war Sir John French was expecting. His sister was against not just the cavalry, but the infantry, too.
Right.
Another one of the families you studied was the fabulous Pankhurst sisters and their mothers. The whole book could have been about the Pankhurst sisters. I think you couldn't have made them up.
That's right. All these people you couldn't have made up. I mean, just take French and Despard. If a novelist wrote a novel, you know, with one character as the commanding general and then his sister as a leading pacifist, you would say implausible. Somebody once said, I wish I could remember who it was, that the nice thing about writing nonfiction is that it doesn't have to be plausible, it just has to be true. And history is so capacious that it gives you characters like this, and you just have to go out and find them. And the Pankhursts, whom you mentioned, was another one of these divided families. Emmeline Pankhurst and two of her daughters, Sylvia and Christabel, were, on the eve of the war, the leaders of the most militant faction of women battling for suffrage.
When you say militant, what exactly do you mean?
They specifically advocated the use of violence in agitating for the right for women to vote. They planted bombs in mailboxes. They blew up buildings. They would pour acid into the grass of golf courses, saying, no votes, no golf, to brand it into the soil.
We don't want any of the kids here today to try this at home, but
It
is possible to pour poison on grass and write messages in golf courses.
cut the telegraph wires from London to Glasgow. They did all kinds of things like this, caused, you know, the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of dollars damages. They sent huge numbers of women on rock-throwing missions through London, throwing rocks at the windows of all male clubs and so on. And Emmeline Pankhurst, on the eve of the war, had been arrested for literally throwing a rock through the window of 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence. The moment the war began, she and her eldest daughter, Christabel, who were living in France as fugitives from justice in England, immediately ceased all political activity, returned to London, put themselves at the service of the British government, which eagerly deployed them on missions, sent them on speaking tours of England, speaking tours of the United States, trying to get the U.S. into the war on the Allied side. At one point sent Emmeline, the mother, to Russia to rally Russian women to the war effort, and financed very generously Christabel to start a rabidly pro-war weekly. Meanwhile, the other daughter, Sylvia, became one of Britain's most outspoken opponents of the war, also published a newspaper, and in it she and her, you know, her newspaper attacked her sister's newspaper and vice versa. And she stopped speaking to her mother and sister. So I don't know quite why the specter of a divided family is so fascinating to me, but I think it is to many of us. Just because we expect families to be tight and to hold together, and when a political issue is so pressing that it divides a family, it's a major thing. And of course, any of us who lived through the Vietnam era in the United States remember that as a time when there was a lot of divisions in families over the issue of a war.
You suggest that there may have been a political motive for feminist leaders to support the war.
Well, I think one thing that Emmeline Pankhurst immediately perceived, this campaign of violence that they had led just prior to the war had actually lost them many supporters. Their supporters were diminishing because people, I think quite correctly, could not quite see the connection between blowing up mailboxes and gaining women the vote. And I think Emmeline immediately saw that the chance to reverse course and put herself at the service of the British government would get her back into the political mainstream, which she'd worked her way out of, and that the war would, and supporting the war would help gain women the right to vote, which indeed it did.
And it did in the United States, too. Wilson supported female suffrage in the United States after the war because women had served their nation so nobly.
Although there was an interesting twist to that in England, the same motive was very much true in the government's pushing through of the right to women to vote in 1918 there. But the problem was that so many men had been killed in the war at this point that if you gave women the right to vote, there would be more women voters than men, and this would never do.
This would be
so
bad.
What did they do? They gave the right to vote only to women over 30. And furthermore, there were a few property qualifications. So that guaranteed that men would be in the majority.
On the anti-war side of the Great Divide in Britain in 1914, one of your central figures is a labor leader named Keir Hardie, who I knew very little about before I read this book, a Scottish labor socialist and member of parliament. Tell us about Keir Hardie.
Well, one of several people I really came to admire very much in the course of writing this book. He was born into absolute dirt floor poverty in Glasgow. His family never had the money to send him to school. He learned to read by reading, adults in his family taught him. And they couldn't afford books, but he picked up pieces of newspaper on the sidewalk. He looked at books that were open in bookstore windows. If there had been a library like this in Glasgow, he would have devoured it, I'm sure. He was at work, and for a time was the sole support of his family when he was 10, 11 years old, because his stepfather was unable to find a job. By the time he was 21, he had spent more than half his life as a mine worker underground, reading by the light on his miner's helmet when he had a spare time. Then he became head of the Scottish Mine Workers Union, active in the Socialist International, the Second International, and never left Scotland till he was 30 years old, but had a kind of instinctive identification with those who were fighting for justice the world over, came to the United States and campaigned for his friend Eugene V. Debs when Debs was running for president, went to India, traveled around the world at one point, went to India, refused to enter any buildings if Indian friends with him were not allowed in as well, went to South Africa, advocated votes for everybody there, which was a tremendously radical position to take at that time, and, you know, white settlers mobbed his hotel and threw rocks and so on. And he saw the war coming and repeatedly spoke out against it and was absolutely devastated when the war broke out and when, you know, he had advocated that at these international meetings that British and French and German and Russian socialists all agree that they would stage a general strike rather than go to war. Couldn't quite get people to agree to this. And then, of course, when the war began, even though I think it's arguable that, labor union members supported it with less enthusiasm than other sectors of the population, they still joined up in huge numbers. And Hardy was completely devastated by this. Meanwhile, throughout this period, he was having a secret love affair with Sylvia Pankhurst, the anti-war daughter of the Pankhurst family. And it's very moving to read their love letters. It was kind of an impossible love. He was twice her age. He was married, had three kids. It would have been disastrous for either of them if this had been found out, because he had very powerful right-wing enemies who would have loved to have pinned a scandal on him. Would have been disastrous for her because she and her mother and sister had been part of a movement that had vowed not to work with male politicians of any party. But they cared about each other passionately, and their love letters survive. And it's a quite moving account of both an intensely passionate love affair that was also really based on a shared passion for justice and a shared fear of the war that they saw coming and feared would jeopardize everything that they fought for.
So you say Keir Hardie was part of this second international of European socialists who called on workers of the world to unite, to refuse to fight. The workers of Germany and the workers of France should not go to war for the ruling classes of their country. They had more in common with each other. Then, of course, August 1914, the workers of the world go out and slaughter each other by the millions. How did Keir Hardie explain this? How do you explain it?
Well, I think I explain it. He was just devastated by it, as was anybody who cared about this sort of thing at that time. I think I explain it by thinking that in all of us, somewhere, there is a tribal gene that is very susceptible to identifying with other members of our tribe, especially when there is enormous social pressure to do so, when there are, you know, huge, you know, when there are bands playing in the street, when there's, you know, tremendous feeling in the air that if you want to be patriotic and do the right thing, you join up and follow the colors and so on. And, you know, you can understand a lot of this in some of the countries involved. You know, it's quite understandable why a French working man or Belgian working man, socialist, whatever convictions, would want to join the army when German troops were pouring across their borders. Even those of us, you know, during the Vietnam War who were opposed to that war, we always used to say we would fight if somebody attacked the United States. Well, you know, for many parts of Europe, that's what actually happened. So you can't sort of dismiss these people out of hand. At the same time, there was a tremendous social pressure in the air. Join the colors, be patriotic. The governments on both sides put a huge amount of resources into propaganda, films, posters, pamphlets, everything you can imagine. This was the first large-scale propaganda war, and this generated more pressure.
Another one of your central figures is Bertrand Russell. He has this wonderful sentence you quote, that he was tortured by patriotism. Tell us about that.
Well, Bertrand Russell was England's greatest philosopher, a pioneer of mathematical philosophy. If anybody ever tells you that they read his greatest work, Principia Mathematica, don't believe them. One biographer of Russell says he doesn't believe that there are more than 20 people on Earth who've actually read this book all the way through and understood it. But Russell also was a marvelous communicator. He wrote very widely on all kinds of topics for a mass audience. And I think what I came to admire about him so much was not only was he a strong opponent of this war, which right from the beginning he saw as absolutely senseless, that there's no great principle involved here. He was intellectually tremendously honest about the conflict in his own feelings. And he talked about how painful and difficult it was to resist this pressure to get, you know, swept up in the vast crowds that were out there parading through the street. And it was painful for him because at one point he said, you know, love of England is very nearly the strongest emotion I possess. And it was very hard to set it aside at a moment like this. So I really respected that honesty about his feelings. He never, let up on these feelings. He continued to write and speak against the war. Scotland Yard banned him from going to certain parts of the country when they saw his speeches taking effect, and he was sent to jail for 6 months in 1918.
So we have Sylvia Pankhurst, we have Keir Hardie, we have Bertrand Russell. What can we say about them except that they failed? Is there anything else to say about this?
Well, they did fail at stopping this war that I think remade the world for the worse in every conceivable way. And let's not forget that not only did it kill some 20 million people, but it also really laid the groundwork for the rise of Nazism, for the coming of the Second World War. It's almost impossible to imagine the Second World War without all of the bitterness that had been engendered by the First and by how it ended. They opposed this, and I think there's something to be said for writing and reading the history of social movements that failed as well as those that succeeded. And I prefer to think of, you know, a movement to stop a senseless war not as something that failed back then, but that hasn't succeeded yet, because we still face the same problem today, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked. You mentioned that propaganda took a great leap forward in World War I. This is government-sponsored pro-war propaganda. Tell us what the innovations were compared to what had happened previously in Europe.
Well, there had never been anything quite like it. And I've constructed this book trying to show all these things through following different characters. And among the characters that I follow is the well-known spy novelist John Buchan, who ended up as Britain's propaganda chief during the war. He was the guy who really invented the modern spy novel. And some of you have probably seen the Hitchcock film, The 39 Steps. That's based on a Buchan novel. And anything you see in any current James Bond film, a sinister conspiracy to destroy the world that's foiled by an athletic hero at the last moment, you know, it's Buchan who invented that whole formula and all the sort of subcategories of it. He was head of the propaganda operation, and it was a propaganda operation that enlisted most of the country's best-known writers. In fact, when they were just a month into the war, the British government convened a meeting of some 50 writers in London, including all kinds of people or household names, H.G. Wells, James Barrie, John Galsworthy, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Kipling.
Actually, Kipling wasn't at that meeting, but he was totally with them in spirit. and had them all around a big table and said, we want you guys to write for the war effort. And whatever you write, we will be sure gets published. So these people kept on writing the as they had before, but very much in the spirit of beating the drums for the war. And whether it was magazine articles, books, pamphlets, or whatever, the government would make arrangements with publishers to buy, 40,000, 50,000 copies, and the book would still appear under the imprimatur of a well-known publisher, but it was subsidized publishing. And they did everything else conceivable. They made posters. They put out a German atrocities calendar with a different atrocity for every month of the year. And they made the first really effective and widely shown propaganda documentary, The Battle of the Somme, which was filmed and shown to more than half the population of the British Isles while this battle, which lasted for about 4 or 5 months, was still going on.
And film is relatively new medium at this. Everyone is not used to going to the double feature on Friday night.
That's right. It was a new medium, and up to that point in time, newsreels had just been, 5 or 6 minute things of sort of ceremonial occasions, the king reviewing a parade or something like this.
Those were great.
So it was a revolutionary thing to have, film of actual soldiers in battle where you see dead bodies, you see wounded soldiers. And the government made a calculation, which they talked about actually internally at the very highest levels. Would this turn people off war if they saw a certain amount of it up close? Or would it make them more empathize with the soldiers' suffering? And they bet on the second alternative, and they were right. Because one of the horrible things, I think, that gives any war momentum is that when you've had a husband who got killed or a son who got wounded, or a brother taken prisoner or something horrible has happened, you want to feel that they haven't died in vain. And so dramatizing some of what the soldiers suffered, which this film did in a somewhat sanitized way, turned out to be enormously effective propaganda. And as soon as the Germans saw that, they did their own propaganda film about the Battle of the Somme.
You mentioned posters. There was that very famous poster that showed two children asking, Daddy, what did you do in the Great War? And you describe a friend of Keir Hardy had an answer.
Said, I tried to stop the bloody thing, my child.
Louise referred to the review that Christopher Hitchens wrote on page one of the New York Times Book Review. He made an argument that actually is not part of your book that I'd like to bring up, because I'm sure at this point a lot more people have read the review than have actually read the book. He argued that America's entry into the war at Woodrow Wilson's urging prolonged the war and thus contributed directly to the rise of Hitler, that if the United States had not entered the war, the two sides would have been exhausted, the end would have come sooner, and that would have been better, would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. I wonder what you think of that argument. Is Woodrow Wilson in some sense responsible for Hitler?
I don't think so. I mean, I was very grateful for this nice review, but I don't think I agree with him on that point. It's true that the entry of American troops into the war was the deciding factor. By the time Armistice Day in 1918, there were 2 million American troops in Europe. And it was clearly that tipped the balance, because at the beginning of the year, there had been many, many more German soldiers than there had been British and French. By the time these 2 million Americans arrived, the balance was tipped very much the other way. But I am not at all confident that there would have been a negotiated peace had the U.S. not entered the war, because both sides had not only vowed to fight to the death, but had acted accordingly. And unlike almost any other war we can think of, there were never any behind-the-scenes peace negotiations going on. Vietnam, They were negotiating at first secretly and then openly in Paris for years before they finally reached a peace agreement. The U.S. is said to be talking to the Taliban now. There was nothing like this going on 1914-19.
You have one person who tried to negotiate this with the Germans.
Yeah, but this was a lone wolf mission that failed. This was another one of the divided families that I follow is a family called the Hobhouses, a remarkable English family full of eccentrics. That's one thing that's so nice about writing about the Brits. And Emily Hobhouse was an extraordinary woman who, a longtime humanitarian campaigner, ardent pacifist, and in 1916, without proper visas or official permission from anybody, she traveled from England through France to neutral Switzerland and into Germany, went to Berlin, went to see the German foreign minister, whom she had known before the war, talked about possible peace terms, thought she heard, I think it was wishful thinking on her part, some things that she thought he might agree to, went back to England, went to see people in the British government, said, what about this, what about that, actually did manage to instigate an exchange of civilian prisoners, which had not yet happened up to that point in time. But otherwise, they brushed aside these peace proposals and wrote her off as an impossible idealist. But I thought she merited a place in this book and in history because in this war that killed more than 20 million people, she was the only person who traveled from one side to the other and back again while it was going on in search of peace.
Amazing story. So you're talking about the Americans being the decisive force that brought the war to an end. My grandfather had been a college student at the University of Wisconsin, studying to be a school teacher, and accepted a commission as a second lieutenant and was sent to fight in France. And we always wanted him to tell us about World War I when we were little kids, and he never wanted to talk about it. And finally, we got him to tell us one thing. What he said was that he fought in the trenches, had been caught on the barbed wire for many hours, but was able to get back to his trench before dawn. And we didn't quite understand. I mean, it seemed like, yes, it would be very uncomfortable to be stuck on barbed wire, but I didn't understand what this really meant until I read your book. You mentioned barbed wire earlier as a great military innovation. Why was barbed wire so important?
Well, because up to this point in time, wars had always been wars of movement. You know, you attack, you have a cavalry charge that, goes for several miles and breaks through the enemy lines. Or, a charge on foot, the Battle of Gettysburg, soldiers moving forward and back and so forth. But you know what barbed wire is, and we're still using descendants of it today, razor wire, which is even more lethal. Imagine a ditch that is maybe, 20, 30 yards wide, filled with tangles of barbed wire. It's impossible for any man or horse or cavalry charge or anything like that to get across. And until they invented the tank, there was really nothing that could cross these fields of barbed wire, which is why, the Western Front was almost unmoved for more than 3 years of the war.
But they tried.
They did try.
They sent, how many men were sent up against the barbed wire?
Again and again and again and again. And what they always thought was, now this time we have a way of getting through, because we only gave them 100,000 artillery shells in the shelling last time, we'll give them 1 million this time, and this shelling is going to break the barbed wire apart.
Do artillery shells break barbed wire?
Usually not.
Usually not.
You have to have a shell that goes off just at, 6 feet above the ground, and that'll destroy it, and, the fuses malfunctioned, and it very seldom happened.
So the commander sent tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops charging into the barbed wire where they would be caught and mowed down by the machine guns. You say British officers sent their men to be massacred with, quote, near criminal disregard, close quote, for them, close quote. And yet there were almost no mutinies, almost no refusals to serve. Why do you think more soldiers didn't see it the way you do?
Well, you know, it's very easy when, you know, we're sitting here decades later to say, well, you know, they ought to have refused to fight in this thing. But, you know, if you do refuse to fight, and you're in an army in the First World War or anywhere else, you know, the penalty is usually death. And that's enough to dissuade anybody from almost anything. There were large-scale mutinies in the French army in 1917, when after a series of particularly disastrous attacks, the same kind of thing, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers dying or being wounded and, you know, gaining a few hundred yards of ground at the most, French soldiers mutinied in huge numbers. It was all hushed up at the time. You know, it was kept out of the newspapers and everything. And they didn't desert, but rather they stayed in their trenches and let it be known to their commanders, we're not going to attack anymore. And, you know, that lasted for the better part of the year. But even then, when there was a big German offensive in 1918, then French soldiers became very aggressive again because they were being attacked. It's just one of these many things that's built into any kind of war where there's horrendous momentum that keeps it going. And it's the kind of thing that made me respect all the more the people who resisted the pressure to get caught up in that momentum.
Let's talk a little bit about your work writing this book. I have to say that reading it is a very overwhelming, devastating experience. I thought I knew a lot about World War I, but to go through all this again, the massive death, the heroic opponents who are defeated and ignored. It's a devastating experience to read about it. You lived with this for a couple of many years of research and writing it. What was it like? Your last book had a happy ending, the abolition of slavery. This book ends with Corporal Hitler is fulminating against Versailles and saying we've got to do something to avenge our humiliation. What was it like to live with this and to work on this?
Well, I always feel less discouraged by the oppressiveness of the villains, so to speak, than I feel inspired by the courage of people who resisted this madness. And some of them are just extraordinarily enjoyable and colorful people as well. One of my favorite characters whom I met in the course of writing this book, very little known, is a man named John S. Clark, who had been born into a circus family in Scotland.
A great one, yeah.
And again, if you were a novelist and made him up, nobody would believe you. He was born into a circus family at age 17. He entered the ring and became the youngest lion tamer in Great Britain.
And you have a picture of him with a lion on his shoulder.
A tiger, yeah. Arm around a tiger. And then he got involved in radical politics. The war came. A friendly policeman tipped him off that he was about to be arrested. He went underground. The entire length of the war, he was the editor of an underground anti-war newspaper that he wrote for a great deal as well. Scotland Yard tried to find him, tried to find where the paper was being printed. They could never find it. After the war, he was able to surface again, went into politics, was briefly a Labour Party member of Parliament, ended his life spending a decade on the Glasgow City Council. When a circus came to town, he would go back into the ring, and at that point was the oldest lion tamer in Great Britain. And you couldn't make up somebody like this. So people like that kept me going. And, you know, I was very moved by, you know, the accounts of some of these resistors and inspired by it. I'll tell you about one episode, which I'm sure you remember from the book, when Britain instituted a draft in 1916. They had not worked out yet a way to deal with people who refused the draft. And instead, everybody, no matter what they said, were, you know, forcibly inducted into the army. And there was one group of 17 resistors, all of them socialists and or Quakers, who just as a matter of principle said, we will not fight. The army said, you guys are enlisted, like it or not. Here are your uniforms. And they refused to take any training. They were held in a prison. And then they were put on a train under guard and told, we're taking you to the front in France. And if you resist there, the penalty is death. And they were desperate. They didn't know what to do. As the train passed through London, one of them was able to write a note and toss it out the train window. But he didn't know if the note had been found. You know, the note said, you know, there's 17 of us, we're being taken to France. If anybody finds this, please contact such and such a peace group. They were taken to France. They again refused to follow orders. They were held in a punishment barracks. The army couldn't believe that there were 17 of them resisting as a matter of principle. So it identified three or four people as ringleaders, court-martialed the ringleaders. They were brought to hear their sentences before a large assembly of several hundred soldiers assembled on a parade ground. And the sentence was read out, you know, for the first man, you know, you're found guilty and you're sentenced to death. And then there was a pause, and the officer reading the sentence said, and commuted to 10 years penal servitude. And what had happened was that a sympathetic railway track worker had found that message that had been tossed out the train window, had taken it to the peace group, which had mobilized Bertrand Russell and several other people. They'd gone to see the prime minister and said, you cannot shoot these men. It just is not right. It can't be done. And the combination of Russell's prestige and the fear that this might give them a black eye in the United States, which they were still desperately eager to induce into the war on Britain's side, led the prime minister to send an order to the commanding general at the front, don't shoot these guys, send them back to England and we'll put them in prison here. But the men didn't know that. But they stuck to their guns nonetheless. And I feel tremendously inspired by people like that. And because they survived, you know, we know how they passed their time in the military prison. The Quakers held a Quaker meeting. They held debates, you know, and they were in an old stables and in what used to be horse stalls. And the only way they could communicate was through knot holes in the walls. You know, we know what they debated. We know the songs that they sang. You know, I love being transported into the lives of people like that, and I find it inspiring. So that's the kind of thing that kept me going.
Let's open it up to questions now. Raise your hand, and we'll send a microphone in your direction. The gentleman back there and the lady here.
How did you get the 9 million civilian death, and where were they?
Okay. Actually, the figure of 9 million, a little more than 9 million, is for military deaths. The estimate on for civilian deaths is 12 to 13 million. One of the problems with calculating civilian deaths in this war is that there's no accurate way of figuring out how many there were. And none of the people who give you those estimates really tell you how they make the calculations. But I think the deaths were probably mainly in the area occupied by Germany, Austria-Hungary, and that huge part of Eastern Europe and Russia, which they occupied, because the British had a very tight naval blockade around Germany and its allies, allowed in no food imports. And Germany had imported more than a quarter of its food before the war. In addition, the fact of the war meant that there was less food produced because young men who would be working at the farms were all at the front, plus nitrates that would have gone into fertilizer went to explosives instead. And there was really widespread near starvation. That The burden of that near starvation was, of course, shifted onto the occupied territories, Russia and Eastern Europe, even more than in Germany. But even in Germany, we know that the average German lost 20% of his or her body weight during the war. Such was the impact of this shortage of food. So I suspect that was the area where most of the civilian deaths took place. Similar conditions prevailed in the Ottoman Empire in Turkey, again because of a cutoff of all imports from the outside.
And we have the Armenian.
The Armenian genocide happened during the war on the excuse that the Armenians, who were within Ottoman Turkey, were, you know, secretly allied with Russia and helping Russia, which was complete nonsense. But more than 1 million Armenians were killed as a result of that. It was one of a number of ethnic score settlings, that there were others in the Balkans, that happened under the cover of this war.
On the aisle.
Yeah, where the microphone is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you find, or were there some changes that were made by higher officers when they would see the continuing death of continued, you know, cavalry and infantry charges onto barbed wire and machine guns? At least did the officers stop wearing different uniforms?
Well, yeah, I mean, the uniforms thing is another peculiar thing. One of many illusions with which this war began, I think, was the illusion that other people wouldn't be shooting at you. You might be shooting at other people, but they wouldn't be shooting at you. I mean, how else can you explain the fact that millions of French soldiers, the entire infantry, went to war in 1914 wearing bright red caps, bright blue tunics, and bright red pantaloons? And same thing for the Austro-Hungarian cavalry, also very fond of red and blue. The French abandoned their red and blue by early 1915. The Austro-Hungarians kept theirs until 1916.
And look what happened to them.
Yeah. And they, you know, the fact that cavalry charges were impossible against barbed wire and machine guns meant that there were very few of them attempted after the beginning of the war. And the Germans and the French were smart enough to actually send their cavalry home. The French deploying theirs for use as strikebreakers because they knew that men on horseback were very useful for that purpose, shutting down strikes of munition workers and so forth. The British kept their cavalry divisions at the front but essentially didn't use them very much. So, you know, yeah, they did learn some things, and by 1918, you know, there were different tactics developed that allowed the Germans to use stormtroopers to penetrate the Allied defenses and the Allies to, you know, integrate infantry and air support in ways that allowed them to advance in return. But, you know, huge bureaucracies like the military tend to learn things very, very slowly.
The woman in the black and white, and then someone on this side, the man in the corner there.
Okay, thank you. I'm a Serbian pacifist and a writer, author. And you're certainly aware of the arrest of General Ratko Mladic, which happened a week ago, yeah? And I followed the trial on Srebrenica, which was, happened in Belgrade, on the Scorpions paramilitary. My grandfather fought the First War. My father fought the Second World War. And I knew all the rhetoric, you know. I was there in the court for the year and a half. And I heard all that patriotic rhetoric. But believe me, you know, and it has nothing to do with what was really going on the ground. And I know that the Serbian part was the aggressor, and I was fighting through all the war against them, and, you know, we all risked our lives doing that. But the thing is that I had a feeling, you know, after writing this book and publishing it, that all new wars have nothing to do with the rhetoric of patriotism, you know, with the words we're using. It's all, like, really ramble. And there are no such things as right wars anymore. You know, there's no moral ideology which justifies. There are no barbed wires. There are no everybody's a victim. You know, this was my conclusion. Can you comment on that, since you're, you know?
Well, I think you're right to be very suspicious of the rhetoric that is used to justify any war. I don't think I'm a complete pacifist. I'm probably about an 80% pacifist, because I do think that there are some wars, regrettably, which probably do have to be fought. But 80% of them don't have to be fought. And you should never, ever believe the rhetoric that is used to justify any war. Just always question it. First World War is such a perfect example, because really up until a few weeks before the fighting began, all of the major nations of Europe were getting along with each other quite well. You know, the royal families, which had a good deal more power than royal families do today, went on yachting vacations together. They were all related. There was a great deal of cross-border trade, joint ventures in business, all kinds of other things, large numbers of people learning each other languages and so forth. Then the war broke out totally senselessly for really no justifiable reasons at all, and immediately gets justified on both sides as a war for civilization itself, for life as we know it. The idea of a war for civilization was the way, tended to be the British and French rhetoric. They couldn't really say it was a war for democracy because they were allied with Tsarist Russia, which was the last absolute monarchy in Europe. Germany used to use the rhetoric that they were fighting the British because if the British prevailed, then the rule of gold would be what would determine the course of world history instead of honor and patriotism and all kinds of good things like that. So just a tremendous amount of hot air that has to be penetrated and looked at very carefully to see what people are really fighting for. One fascinating things to me about the First World War was that the longer it went on, the more you really did begin to see all of the territorial ambitions of both sides. They were both after each other's colonies in Africa. The Germans dreamed of establishing a sort of solid band of territory that would stretch across the whole continent by grabbing British and French and Belgian colonies. The British were so naked in their territorial ambitions that they established a committee of the cabinet during the war with the remarkably unsanitized name of the Territorial Desiderata Committee to sort of stake out which pieces of enemy territory they would like to acquire after the war. And perhaps the most fateful of those was the three provinces of Ottoman Turkey that were cobbled together as the British protectorate of Iraq. So, what happens when we go into Iraq, 80 years later? Again, all kinds of rhetorical, justification. We're looking for weapons of mass destruction. Well, no, we didn't find those, but we're trying to bring democracy to the Arab world. Well, no, we're overthrowing a dictator, there's always a string of rhetorical justifications which have to be questioned very, very closely, whatever the war.
We have one over here.
This will be a little lighter question. There's a story I've heard about or read about of a soccer game, I think at Christmas time between the Germans and the British, and I'm surprised it hasn't been a Disney/Rocky 10 movie yet, but is that a true story? Did you find out stuff about that?
Yeah, this is the famous Christmas Truce of 1914, where on Christmas Day, what happened on the Western Front, which was, the line across northern France and a corner of Belgium with British and French troops on the one side, German troops on the other side, was that rather spontaneously, soldiers on both sides began making it clear that they would not fight if the other side didn't fight. Somebody waved a white flag, somebody popped their head out of a trench, finally a whole soldier came out of a trench, and along about two-thirds of the front line, all shooting stopped, men came out into no man's land, there were some soccer games, there were exchanges of German beer for British rum, People got photographed together in no man's land. You can see these photographs. Officers as high as the rank of lieutenant colonel came out, met their counterparts. People traded souvenirs. A lot of Germans spoke English because they had lived in England before the war. There were something like 50,000 Germans living in England, in the years leading up to 1914. And it is something that has been memorialized in films. There's a French film, Joyeux Noël, based on the Christmas truce. Paul McCartney, I think, did a music video based on it. There's some songs based on it. It really did happen. Sadly, it never happened again in the remaining several Christmases of the war. The generals saw to that.
Two more questions. So we'll have the lady here, and let's see, on this side we need somebody. How about down here in front?
You haven't mentioned yet one of my political heroes. Do you have anything you'd like to say about Fenner Brockway?
I certainly do. An extraordinary man who's one of the characters in this book. And he had been the editor of a newspaper before the war, actually a labor newspaper started by Keir Hardie, whom we talked about. He was a conscientious objector, an absolutist, as they called them. One of the 6,000 young men in Britain who went to jail refused the option given to conscientious objectors of working in war industries or driving an ambulance at the front, went to prison. In prison, he remained a newspaper editor and published a newspaper for his fellow inmates on toilet paper. The price of a subscription was one sheet of your toilet paper. And he kept this going for a year, published a commemorative issue on the 2 years after the death of Keir Hardie, published what was probably the first honest account in Britain of the Battle of Passchendaele, another one of these enormous unnecessary slaughters, because there was an army deserter who was in the same prison who told them about it. After a year, the authorities discovered this newspaper, shut it down, threw him in solitary confinement. And there's a very moving description in his autobiography, I have it near the end of the book, where he's still in solitary confinement on a restricted diet for this crime of having published a newspaper when Armistice Day comes. And he had heard word that fighting was going to stop, you know, at 11 o'clock on November 11th, 1918. He was not allowed a watch, but he'd figured out how to tell time by where the sunbeam came on the wall of his prison cell and sort of counted the minutes until 11 o'clock. And then when he saw the sunbeam strike that spot, he could hear cheering outside the prison walls, and he wept. Very moving account that he left.
Last question.
I haven't read the book yet. Do you cover the trench poets? And President Bush always says that the jury's out on him as far as his decision for this war. I'd like you to comment on that. Thank you.
I'll do the second part first. I think the jury has come back from its deliberations on that score. And I don't think history is going to have any doubt that this was a war that did not have to be fought. And which, like many wars, you know, there seemed to be some justification at the start, but it ended up lasting much, 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 much longer than anybody expected and causing all kinds of problems that no one anticipated. The trench poets I don't talk about much in the books, not because I don't respect them. I think Wilfred Owen is one of the greatest poets in the English language in the 20th century.
You have some of Wilfred.
I do have a little bit of his poetry there, but I didn't want to talk about them just because there's so many books about these guys already, deservedly so. And I sort of left out other people that I think a lot of you know about already, the trench poets, the Bloomsbury set, and so on. I'd rather introduce you to my lion tamer and to some people like that whom you don't know about. So that's what I tried to spend my pages doing.
I'd like to end by asking you to read one of my favorite passages from your book. This is about your travels when you were doing your research.
And this refers back to your somebody's question about the Christmas truce. And I'm talking about, I sort of begin and end the book with visits to the area of the old Western Front in Belgium and northern France, where I'm sure some of you have been there. You know, you go to the area of any of the areas where there was a huge amount of fighting and you stand on a hilltop and everything you can see in all directions is graveyards. This thin band of territory stretching through northern France in this corner of Belgium has the greatest concentration of young men's graves in the world. Mile after mile of orderly thickets of white tombstones or crosses climb low hills and spread through gentle valleys, dotted here and there with the spires, columns, and rotundas of larger shrines. From the New Zealand Monument in Messines, Belgium, to the South African National Memorial at the Somme battlefield in France, to the less grand cemeteries holding the bones of Senegalese troops or Chinese laborers, the land is dotted with reminders of how far men traveled to die. Even those lucky enough to be in a marked grave were sometimes buried twice over after cemeteries from the first year or two of the war were blown up by shells in later battles. Today, there are more than 2,000 British cemeteries alone in France and Belgium, cared for by almost 500 gardeners. An entire week of travel along the old Western Front, however, reveals only a single memorial celebrating anyone for doing something other than fighting or dying. A few miles outside of Ypres, across a one-lane country road from a brick barn, is a chest-high cross of sturdy wooden beams, stained dark. Next to it is a small fir tree in a pot, blown over by the summer wind. Three silver balls are still attached to it, for it is a Christmas tree. And this homemade cross, not erected or maintained by any country's official graves agency, stands in memory of the soldiers from both sides who took part in the Christmas truce of 1914. One of the soccer games in no man's land that day is said to have taken place near this spot. Stuck into the ground around the cross are more than a dozen smaller wooden crosses, a foot or so long, which you can buy in nearby shops that cater to battlefield visitors. In remembrance is stamped on each in English, and you can write in a soldier's name beneath it. But on one of the little crosses, in the space for that name, someone has written all of you, and above that, imagine.
Thank you, Adam. Thanks to everybody who came today.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.